This is the Mother Jones Podcast. I'm Jamila King in Brooklyn. On today's show, have you gotten your COVID vaccine yet? Vaccines are here and people are getting them, finally, but not everyone. And we're going to dig into some of those issues today because it's important. In some places, like my neighborhood in Brooklyn, where do you go to get one? How do you know if you're eligible? We've got a new Johnson & Johnson vaccine happening.
It prevents hospitalization and death 100% of the time.
We've got some concerns around equity and efficacy.
Those who can get ahead of the line make their way ahead of the line.
You need answers, so we got them. Joining me today are two of my favorite colleagues, reporters at Mother Jones, who've been following the coronavirus pandemic since it started a year ago. Stay tuned. Kira Butler is a senior editor and public health reporter at Mother Jones. She's been tirelessly covering the coronavirus pandemic since the beginning. Welcome to the show, Kira.
Thanks. I'm so happy to be here.
Edwin Rios is a reporter at Mother Jones. He covers education and has been largely covering how the coronavirus has impacted communities of color over the last year. So good to have you on, Eddie.
Thanks, Jamila.
Kira, there's been a lot of coronavirus news lately. What are you focused on this week?
I think vaccines and variants are the top two things that I'm thinking about this week. We have the great news about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that was approved by the FDA.
America's COVID fight has a new weapon. A third vaccine made by Johnson & Johnson is set to ship out.
We're recording this on Monday. Doses are going to be shipped out starting tomorrow, which is Tuesday.
The trucks are literally rolling off the docks as we speak, and we hope to be able to get shots in arms with literally in the next 24 to 48 hours.
3.9 million doses are the first initial shipment. Which is really great news.
The big differentiator, of course, for the J&J vaccine is that it's just one shot and you're done.
At the same time, we have a few variants of concern.
A new coronavirus variant is on the rise in New York City.
The New York variant is the one that I've seen a lot of people talking about. That one seems to be spreading really quickly. I think the figure that I saw was something like 27% of cases in New York City reflect this new variant.
And health officials warn it shares some similarities with a more transmissible and intractable one first discovered in South Africa.
Researchers racing to find out whether it is more contagious, more deadly, and whether the current vaccines work against it.
And there is some limited evidence that it might pose a problem in terms of the existing vaccines.
And so we have these vaccines. How's the vaccine rollout going? I know in New York, it is not easy.
Yeah. You know, I think that it's a different situation in every state, in every city. You know, the priority groups vary so much from place to place. But in general, there has been a lot of progress made just since January. More than 49.7 million Americans have gotten at least the first dose. That's according to the CDC. And about 24.7 million people have received both doses. That's like 7.5% of the U.S. population. Fewer than 10% of people 65 plus had been vaccinated by the end of January. Now, I think more than half have is the latest statistic that I have heard. More than half of people 65 plus. So that's really, really impressive, that progress that we've made.
That's great. And Eddie, you're in Oakland, California. How are things out on the West Coast?
Things are as you might expect. I think there's a bit of concern around how the vaccine has been distributed out here, particularly when you think about the communities most affected, or disproportionately affected, rather, by this pandemic. We've seen reports of California residents in neighboring counties making their ways to the Oakland Coliseum, which is a major massive vaccination site, reportedly misusing these vaccine access codes that were meant for communities of color that were most affected. And so what we're seeing in a way is more of the same story of those who can get ahead of the line, make their way ahead of the line.
Got it. So like you said, Kira, we got a new vaccine, Johnson & Johnson. It's been approved by the FDA. How is it different from the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines?
A few really important differences. One is that it is only one dose, so there's no scheduling a second appointment with this one. Another difference is that it doesn't require the extremely cold temperatures, extremely low temperatures that the other vaccines do. So it can be stored in a regular doctor's office much more easily than the other two doses. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine is a little bit less effective than the Pfizer and Moderna. It's about 66%, but the most recent data is very encouraging in terms of variants. It does seem to be pretty effective against the South African variant, which is one of the big ones that people are concerned about.
And let's be real, Kira, what does the word efficacy even mean? I hear that term bandied about a lot, but I don't know that people actually know what it means for a vaccine to have different standards of efficacy.
That's a great question. And it really requires us to think back to why we wanted vaccines in the first place, which was to prevent people from getting so sick that they end up in the hospital and that they overwhelm hospital resources. And of course, we want to prevent people from dying of the coronavirus. So when you hear 66% efficacy compared to the incredible efficacy of the Pfizer and Moderna in the 90s, you might think that this new vaccine is just not as great. But a very important thing to keep in mind is that it prevents hospitalization and death 100% of the time, as far as we know, which is just really exceptional and a result that every public health official that I've talked to is just thrilled with.
Wow, that's huge. So, Kira, what's happening with kids getting the vaccine?
Well, some trials are underway for teenagers. So there are trials underway for 12 to 17-year-olds. Trials, I think, are just beginning, just being recruited for ages 6 to 12. I think it's going to be a while before we see trials for the youngest kids. The estimates that I've heard, people are thinking that maybe kids, school-age kids, kids 6 and up, might be able to be vaccinated in the fall. Which means, you know, we may have a situation where at the start of the next school year, kids will be returning to school without being fully vaccinated.
And Eddie, you cover education often at Mother Jones. There's a lot of controversy over teachers getting vaccinated and schools reopening. How's that playing out from your standpoint?
Yeah, so right now it's an interesting dilemma in that you have multiple layers there. You have a battle ongoing with the teachers' unions across the country in which they are looking out for the health and safety of their members. And, you know, they're being the most cautious about school reopening and, you know, hoping for teachers either to be fully vaccinated or to have precautions in place so that they can safely reopen doors out of fear that kids would transmit the virus to them. But then you have the pushes from the parents involved. Like you have, and there's a disparity there as well. Black and brown parents have been disproportionately affected by this pandemic, and they're also the most cautious to reopen schools. Whereas the most vocal proponents have been, you know, white parents, actually. And so that's really driving the dynamics of the school reopening debate right now. You know, the Biden administration has pushed for, you know, school reopening to happen. But there's only so much that the federal government can do. So much of this is going to be debated and fought over at the local level.
Eddie, that's so interesting. You know, it makes me think about a lot of your reporting over the past year around tracking inequities in the pandemic. So what I'm hearing you say is that on the one hand, Black and brown parents are being disproportionately impacted by coronavirus, whether it's being infected, having family members infected, getting sick, going to the hospital, dying, or losing their jobs. But they are the most concerned about putting their kids back in school. What sort of historical stuff plays into that?
Yeah, I think a big part of it is there's a deep-seated institutional mistrust that, you know, pervades not just the school reopening debate, but I mean, really, it's at the heart of the vaccine rollout as well. It's this concern that schools are not necessarily at a place right now that where kids can be fully protected.
I get the sense from your reporting and my own lived experience that, you know, Black and brown parents just generally don't trust local and federal governments for very, very good reasons. And so the mandate to reopen classrooms might be sort of counterintuitively dangerous in some ways.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And as you said, like that mistrust is not unfounded. And that's what gets at the complexity of all this. You know, it's easy to say, let's just reopen schools, but without truly understanding the why and truly understanding the motives for and what and how that affects parents and students at the hardest, really, it's not an easy yes. It's not an easy let's just go back to school. And that's why it's taking so long in a way. That's why there's so much debate happening.
Right. Eddie, let's talk through some of what you found. How are communities being disproportionately impacted by the pandemic?
What's so interesting about that question is that it should be of no surprise. This pandemic has essentially worsened the inequities that were already prevalent in our society that have become such a fabric of our American life. Like, I've talked to so many health equity experts who've said, we're not surprised by this. At first, it was so much of the conversation revolved around Black and brown folks being more likely to have pre-existing health conditions. But what we've figured out throughout the course of this pandemic, it's really, the coronavirus is a pandemic, it's more so a social pandemic. It's one, and it's an economic one. Black and brown folks are more likely to be exposed to the virus through their work settings, and they're more likely to be considered essential workers, and therefore they're more likely to catch the virus, while their white counterparts are more likely to stay home and have jobs that stay home. And the inequities are not just health inequities. They are economic, they are social, there's intergenerational loss that comes with the loss of life. Black and Latino folks not only face losses in life expectancy of up to 3 years of loss of life, but they also suffer generations worth of lost years just because they tend to die younger of the coronavirus than white Americans. They've suffered, you know, greater job losses. And if the Great Recession taught us anything, like, that'll take longer for them to recover from those economic losses than the rest of Americans.
So it seems like collecting data on all of this is really hard. How do you get the data? How do you make sure that the data is reliable? And how are you making sense of it?
Yeah, it's interesting how the passage of time makes things a little clearer. And, you know, in the beginning of the pandemic, when we first started reporting about these inequities, the data was hard to come by. I would essentially look at what was going on nationally. I would see the big aggregate numbers and wonder, wait, like, how is it affecting different communities? To understand the scope of the problem, you have to know what the problem looks like. And there were politicians like Elizabeth Warren at the time and civil rights groups who were demanding the CDC under the Trump administration publish data on COVID by race. But that was hard to come by. And so what I did, I ended up reaching out to health departments across the country just to ask a simple question of, like, what data do you hold on infections and deaths by race? And some states like Nebraska, like, just hadn't published that data, even as we started hearing reports of outbreaks at meatpacking facilities whose workforces include immigrants. And meanwhile, some other states like Michigan and Wisconsin were quick and were among the first to report data by race. So I ended up reaching out to all those health departments, gathering all that data, teaming up with our data guru, Sanduja, and we published one of the first definitive looks at the pandemic's toll on communities of color. And over time, that data has gotten better. There have been independent groups like APM Research Lab and COVID Ratio Data Tracker who've kind of kept the collection of that data possible. And now the CDC has pretty firm and reliable data, but the data is still concerning. We still know that Black, Latino, and Native Americans are dying at twice the rate of white Americans of COVID. We know that younger Black Americans between the ages of 30 and 49 are four times as likely to die of COVID than white Americans in the same age group. Native Americans who are even younger, 18 to 29, are dying at 12 times the rate of white Americans in the same age group. So if anything, the pandemic has showed us that those inequities that we were worried about prior to the pandemic, they've just worsened. And the pandemic essentially just opens the curtains to that. And I'm reminded of, I was talking to a Flint pediatrician, and he told me that if history tells us anything, if America catches a cold, communities of color catch pneumonia. So we suspected the same would happen during this pandemic, and in a sad, sad way it has.
Kira, what are you hearing about how public health officials are trying to address these sort of inequities that Eddie's been reporting on?
I think it varies a lot from place to place, you know, and I think that I've heard a lot of public health officials talking about who the best messengers are, both in terms of, social distancing messages and information about how to protect yourself, but also in terms of vaccine acceptance. I think we're realizing that you can't really take a paternalistic approach when it comes to getting people to understand public health guidelines. It's not enough just to have Dr. Fauci up there on a podium talking about what you should and shouldn't do. People need to hear these things from folks that they trust. And so, you know, more and more, I think public health officials are recommending that the health department team up with local leaders, with church leaders, with school leaders. There are leaders in the community that people have a relationship with. And, you know, survey after survey finds that people trust what their primary care physician says more than they trust what a government official says. So, you know, I think that going forward, that flow of communication, you know, from CDC to these local leaders is going to really be key.
Coming up after the break, the vaccine rollout. What's gone right? What's gone wrong? And who is cutting the line? We get into it. Stick around. If you want to support us at the Mother Jones Podcast, it's so easy to do. Just go to wherever you're listening to this episode and hit that subscribe button. It helps a lot. Thanks.
Mother Jones stories you're hearing right now are brought to you by our listeners and loyal readers who fuel our work. Audience support makes up 2/3 of the Mother Jones budget and helps our team dig deep on stories that matter. Make a donation at motherjones.com/give to keep our nonprofit newsroom humming. Again, that's motherjones.com/give.
Welcome back to the show. We're talking to Mother Jones reporters Kira Butler and Edwin Rios about the coronavirus vaccine rollout. Let's dive back in. Eddie, vaccination rates have been lower among communities of color across the country. What are some of the reasons for that?
It's a combination of things. To step back a bit, to put that problem in a bit of perspective, right now we know that thankfully, you know, Kira gave some incredible numbers earlier, but a slice of that is just 6% of those who got the first dose of the vaccine were Black, and they account for nearly 16% of deaths, COVID deaths, and they only make up 12% of Americans. And, you know, if you look to Latino Americans, it's that number is 9% who've gotten the first dose, even though they account for 18% of COVID deaths. And so what you see those low vaccination rates, and it fuels this concern that if my community members are not getting the vaccine, how am I supposed to get the vaccine? And also remember that the pandemic exacerbates pre-existing inequities. It's not as if those barriers kind of, the barriers to access go away when the vaccine rollout starts. So people who don't speak English may face difficulties in scheduling appointments if there's not a concerted effort at information distribution across languages. You know, people still lack sufficient internet access, so there may be just problems making a vaccine appointment in the first place. And yes, misinformation is a problem as well, but also misinformation capitalizes on the worries and uncertainty and mistrust that already exists. So it's a combination of problems that, you know, collide and lead to these lower vaccination rates among communities of color.
We've been hearing horror stories about making vaccine appointments. I've experienced it myself here in New York City. What are you guys hearing about that? And what kind of factors go into how easy or difficult the rollout's been?
You know, I think what Eddie was saying before about internet access has become a huge barrier in terms of making vaccine appointments. I did some reporting last month in a rural community in Georgia where the town had gotten in trouble because they had vaccinated teachers before the state had okayed that. This was an accident. They didn't mean to do it, but they did. So as a punishment, the state of Georgia took away their vaccines for 6 months. And, you know, some folks asked, well, that's okay. You know, why couldn't folks in that town just get on the internet and make themselves an appointment in a neighboring county and at a grocery store nearby? Well, you know, in rural America, not everybody has access to the internet. And in some places, internet is not reliable. So, you know, while you might be able to say that to somebody in a city who has internet access and it's reliable, that might be fine, but it's not that way in rural places. In addition to that, you know, so far, the main group that's been making appointments has been elderly people, and not all of them are comfortable making appointments online. So this has been, you know, you've seen a situation where elderly folks with younger people in their lives who have the time and wherewithal to constantly refresh websites and try to make appointments, they're getting the vaccine. Whereas folks who don't have that are having a much harder time. So I think that's been one major, major hiccup so far.
Joe Biden seems to be taking this much more seriously than Donald Trump. There's been a lot of money awarded to groups to specifically message communities of color who've been underserved by messaging from public health officials. How do you think they can break through, and what do these messengers need to be saying?
I think a large part of this is as that money goes to different groups, the groups themselves need to consider who locally are those trusted messengers. And I mean, go as like zoom in as close as possible, like go where the people are at. So if they're at churches, go to churches, and the messaging needs to be clear and consistent and varied in by language. Or what you want to do is eliminate the barriers that have been put in place before. And in order to do that, in order to break those barriers, you need to go to where people are and go and understand how the networks work.
One positive development that I've seen is that the Biden administration has pumped a bunch of cash into community health clinics. And these are places where they work in underserved communities, and they really, really understand the needs of these communities. And leveraging these spaces that already exist, where there's already trust, where people already have a primary care physician, and where the doctors there really have a good on-the-ground sense of what the community needs are, what the concerns are, what the trust barriers might be. You know, I think this is going to be a really big factor in vaccine acceptance and also in spreading public health messaging in general.
We just got news that outbreaks have been linked to colleges. Kira, is that a surprise?
Well, considering what we saw in the late summer and early fall when campuses opened back up, we saw a bunch of outbreaks then. I would say no, it's not a surprise. You know, these are conditions that the virus loves. These are a bunch of young people living in dorms, being in really close contact. It seems like we would have learned something from the first time this happened. So it's a little bit disheartening to see it happening again.
Kira, Eddie, so good to have you both on. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, Jamila.
I'm Andrea Guzman, and I'm a fellow in the San Francisco office. Right now, I'm working on a timeline about moments from U.S. history that triggered large-scale loss of land owned by Indigenous, Black, Latino, and Asian farmers. Here are the credits for today's show. Theme music for the Mother Jones podcast was composed by Micah Barrick at HearFilm. The episode was produced by Molly Schwartz, our associate producer, and James West, our executive producer. Molly did the mixing and editing, James did the mastering, with additional production by Mark Helenowski and Jamila King. And credit where credit is due. Mother Jones is supported by you, our listeners and readers. So thanks.
That's it for this week's episode of the Mother Jones podcast. As always, if you want to support the podcast, it's very easy to do. Just hit that subscribe button. Also, go to motherjones.com/survey and help us help you make sense of the news. I'm your host, Jamila King. See you next week.
This podcast is brought to you by Mother Jones listeners like you who donate to keep our newsroom buzzing. Help us stay on the beat. Go to motherjones.com/give.